balance with the natural world. I think that's the only way we can survive. And I think this is just the first 50 years of it.
Mark Kitchell, I want to thank you for being with us, director of A Fear Screen Fire, which airs on PBS American Masters tonight at 9 p.m. Eastern. Tonight on this day, Earth Day. You can visit our website for a link to local listings. Today is Earth Day, and you can tell us how you're involved, if you are, with the environmental movement, who inspires you. Go to our Facebook page, and on Twitter, you can use the hashtag DiscussDN. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Renee Felsar, Mate Nermin Sheikh, Steve Martinez, Sam Akafani Masood, Rabbi Karen, Dina Gazdari, Midlifu, Cassandra Lazare, Messiah Rhodes, Tarina Nadura, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Noguera are our engineers. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Julie Crosby, Hugh Grant, Jessica Lee, John Wallach, Vesta Godars, and to our camera crew, John Randolph, Karen Kirk-Meadows, Carol Ojeda-Jesus, and Phil Raymond. I'm Amy Goodman. Happy Earth Day. Thanks for joining us.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, where the time is now 8:01. Coming up next is the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show with our hosts Abe Proctor and Joe Uris. Today we'll talk about the history of modern capitalism.
KBOO is a proud co-sponsor of the 2014 Earth Day celebration, Saturday, April 26th, from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. at Kenton Park on North Brandon and North Kilpatrick Streets in Portland.
The Earth Day 2014 theme, Reverse Migration, will focus on local culture and businesses. Over 100 sustainable businesses and organizations, including KBOO Community Radio, will participate in this event.
This celebration will also feature lots of live music and entertainment. Celebrate our planet at the 2014 Earth Day celebration, Saturday, April 26th, from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. at Kenton Park. More information on this event can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Organizing and Winning for 21st Century Movements, Wednesday, May 7th, 7:15 p.m. at Portland State University. The speakers for this event will be Steve Early, author of Save Our Unions, Dispatches from a Movement in Distress, journalist Aaron Gupta, founder of The Independent and the Occupied Wall Street Journal, and Joanna Brenner, retired PSU faculty member who writes on feminist theory and politics. Again, that's Wednesday, May 7th at Portland State University Smith Center, room 238, at 1825 Southwest Broadway in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Merrillhurst University, with 5 part-time MBA programs that combine classic business skills with an emphasis on creative thinking, ethical decision-making, and sound judgment, the hallmarks of a liberal arts perspective. June 6th information session, merrillhurst.edu.
We are trying to locate an Estelle subscriber. You are trying to reach Nasty. Except in a world and windows, MTV. Always Tampax and Gotex, Sam's, McDonald's, Subway, Burger King. Except in a world and windows, MTV. MTV, 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 MTV. Twitter, WhatsApp, inbox, 1, 2, 3. We need the move to a story, Barney. Disneyland, Box Pony, pizza, burger, sandwich, coffee, please. Hot dog, Ken, Donkey, teacher, Lilo and Stitch, what is your name, Will Smith? Arnold Schwarzenegger, and Bruce Lee. VIP, VIP, VIP,
What is that?
That isn't Let It Be.
The Three Sad Tigers out of Mexico.
The They're Three very, very Sad funny. Tigers. Yeah. They're very funny.
They are. They have lots of funny songs.
Oh, okay. This is KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland, Oregon. This is the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show with Abe Proctor and me, Joe Uris.
It's an ironic song.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's about capitalism.
So. Bitter song. Bitter.
It was originally a song about transcendence, about letting go of your problems, about finding that calm place inside.
And having
and
faith.
Clarity and having faith.
Yeah,
and they just made it all about corporations.
Oh.
See, that's irony.
Yeah. Oh, is that
irony?
It's
a very useful tool.
It's just true. 231-8187 is the number to call to be on the air here. We're going to remind you, we got the 3-minute limit now. So what you want to do if you want to be on the air is, first of all, kind of think of your thoughts as something you need to get out in rational order in 3 minutes. Not that hard to do, but it's...
That's what it's come to, you listeners.
What?
We're asking you to order your thoughts ahead of time.
Well, yeah, come on.
Don't just let it flow.
Oh,
think about it first.
I don't mean to be insulting. What we're going to be talking about today is capitalism in the 21st century.
Yeah, and I thought we could also, you know, talk about capitalism down through the ages.
Well, okay, if you really want to do that.
Get there. Well, yeah. You know, something we always strive to do on this show is provide historical context.
Belle Époque.
Right.
Stuff like that.
Yeah. Yeah, the early signs of mercantile capitalism during the colonial era and on and on.
Okay.
Yeah. But we'll get there.
We can do that. Yeah. We can do that. Thomas Piketty put out a book that has turned into a surprise bestseller. It is the first wholly critical... rational criticism of current-day America and Europe and other capitalist empires.
What's it called?
It's called Capital in the 21st Century.
Well, that's apt.
Well, yeah, kind of hearkening back to the original Das Kapital by Karl Marx. Mm-hmm. Ooh, bad man, Karl Marx.
So who's the author? Piketty.
Piketty.
He's French, right?
Yeah, he
so
is.
So why should we listen to anything he has to say?
Why? What? I don't know how to respond to that. Because he's smart and because he's really impressed a lot of people in the world of economics and because he's probably correct in his analysis. What he does, basically, let me just lay this out and then we'll talk more about the issues involved in his book. First of all, he shows that the way to measure concentration of wealth is not salaries, not wages, but in fact holdings.
Right. Wealth. Total wealth.
Wealth. Total wealth. And that has been largely ignored.
Not just income.
Right. Not just income. That has been totally ignored. And in fact, if you use that measure, 1% of 1%, just like the movement developed in, a year ago? More than a year ago?
Which movement are you talking about?
I'm talking about the
the Occupy movement?
Yeah, the Occupy movement.
Yeah, that was what... Three, 4 years ago now.
Is it really? Am I that old? It's all terribly falling apart. Okay, Occupy movement. Well, it turns out its accusation was absolutely correct. And that wealth resides more and more in the hands of fewer and fewer extremely wealthy people whose insights and orientation is really separate from yours and mine.
Yeah, really, almost as if they're living in different worlds.
They are living in different worlds.
And the ramifications for our lives is that, as Paul Krugman said recently in an interview with Bill Moyers, and you can find a link to that interview on our show page, by the way, he says that we're rapidly becoming the sort of society we've always imagined that we're not, which is a society of inherited wealth, a plutocracy, if you will, in which a landed and very wealthy set of aristocrats essentially rules us.
Yeah, and I think that's correct, and I think it's an important thing to look at. And what Piketty did very carefully is used the metrics of economics to examine this pattern and to show how absolutely definitively wealth has accrued at the top and how impacting that is in our system.
Yeah.
It's pretty important stuff. So really, I think what we need to really understand, what we need to deal with is this reality. And this book, by the way, as I said earlier, has become very popular. A lot of people reading it because it really does demystify the stuff out of the Chicago School and all these other economic institutional structures that argue that it's all right, that anybody can become wealthy, that opportunities are abounding and that there is no real inequality of any significant sort. All wrong. Hmm. Inequality is very powerful. Inequality is, particularly with recent Supreme Court decisions, inequality is the ruling force in our social system.
So it sounds like this book is very useful for progressives because it gives us the language to articulate our struggle as we try to push back at what times seems to be sort of a white noise of resistance out there. So this allows us to put names on it and get a grip on it.
Right. And what he's done, because he is French, is look at the Belle Époque in France, the time of enormous wealth, and how wealth and concentration developed in that country, as well as how it developed in this country today, and sees certain kinds of parallels, even though the technologies of the two eras are very different.
And the Belle Époque is exactly when in France? This is before the First World War?
Yeah.
Okay.
So it's actually late 19th century.
All right. So sort of parallels the Gilded Age in the United States.
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, absolutely.
Similar sort of phenomenon.
Yeah. And in fact, if you're interested in the Gilded Age, there's a great book by Mark Twain on the very same subject.
And the levels of inequality we're experiencing now are at least comparable to those of the Gilded Age, if not.
Right.
In excess of those.
And the period of time which we all have as our framework, if we're over the age of 50, and even those of us, many of us who are under that age, the framework that we have about the United States is built on the post-World War II boom, which in France and Europe is called either the economic miracle in Germany or the 30 glorious years in which economic growth took place and money accrued at the top at the same time that consumer goods and wages went up to a point where people could live comfortably. Now that is being reversed. Now there's a certainty, and this guy Piketty shows it graphically. Shows how we are, in fact, in the West, becoming more and more poor, actually really poor, and that this pattern, if unchecked, will go on and on and on. And I'll cut to the chase. His solution is very basic. He is not opposed to capital accruing. He is not opposed to a capitalist system per se. But what he does say is you must tax wealth, and you must tax it severely. He would go back to the time when, for example, in the United States, wealth was taxed at a pretty high rate. In fact, income taxes were at their highest during this time of great growth after World War II. And now they're relatively low.
So essentially, what many of us came to understand in this country as the way things work, which was framed by those several decades of the post-war period, it's looking more and more like that's a historical anomaly, that we're drifting back towards rule by a very wealthy elite, such as we have always seen throughout human history.
Yeah, well, what we're seeing is a trending steadily and certainly to 1% of 1% holding more and more of the land, of the gold, as it were, the money, and more and more of the assets of the land of the whole world, really. And that this pattern is unchecked is particularly noxious and noticeable in the United States today because we have a bizarre Supreme Court. And a bizarre Congress, which in the case of Congress either does nothing or does bad things.
Well, it's not so bizarre when you evaluate it in terms of very concentrated capital.
Right.
Then it's perfectly logical.
It's serving the interests of the ruling class.
Right.
Just like them damn Marxists said.
Yep.
Yeah. Very disturbing.
But very so how true. Does this all work? Lay it out for us, Joe.
Well, what do you mean, how does it all work? Well, first of all.
How does capital become accumulated like
Well, it's untaxed. That's the key. Because you don't tax it adequately, you don't redistribute this vast wealth. The argument in this country is ideological. Well, these are the job creators. Well, they're not particularly.
They're not particularly
the job creators. In fact, what happens is that this money is inherited, passed down through generations. Mm-hmm. The people inheriting it may be good people or bad people. They may do good or bad things with their money, but basically they enrich themselves. And they marry each other.
They
become a class apart from the rest of us. And in that process, the amount of available wealth is concentrated and concentrated and concentrated, while the rest of us have to make do with the leftovers. That's it.
And this has happened as our as our wage economy has declined,
yes.
as manufacturing jobs have left,
right.
and the financial sector has grown to become to exert a disproportionate influence on the rest of the economy.
Yeah, and the simplest way to see it is look at the enormous amounts of money, millions and millions and millions of dollars in wages and benefits that are given to the heads of these financial corporations and other corporations.
Yeah. Not even wages, bonuses. Even.
Bonuses. Just to hand the money
yeah.
over.
Yeah, here it is.
Yeah.
Yeah, even if you run a company into the ground, even if you jeopardize the entire global system.
Right.
With your excess.
Exactly. No, and it's really important to understand this. A lot of what we're taught in school, a lot of what we have come to accept is a notion that really what's wrong is dysfunctions within a very functional system that is very fair, that rewards initiative and hard work and creativity.
And talent.
Yeah. Talent, all that. Well, it turns out, yeah, there's some of that, but the basic wealth of the nation, of the world, in fact, is accruing steadily and constantly and gigantically in the hands of a very, very few very, very wealthy families.
And the sovereignty and the power of nation states become less and less relevant.
Absolutely.
It matters less and less what the United States government decides to do. It matters more and more the extent to which that government is an appendage of the ruling class.
Right. Right. And there are other factors involved. The age of people, of workers, you know, in the United States mm-hmm. is declining. The number of workers in the United States that make a good living is declining. The overall forces that drive the economy create a real problem that is a problem of what is used to be called supply and demand. Right now, all the emphasis in economics, all the emphasis in the public sphere is constantly about creating stuff. But there's no discussion of creating demand. In order for there to be demand, there has to be money in the hands of working people.
Yes. It's consumers who create jobs.
Right.
They're the job creators.
Right.
By buying stuff, they create a demand for that stuff, which requires a vacuum to be filled. Stuff needs to be made, and people need to be paid to make it.
Yeah.
That's what creates jobs.
And the process in which you have slow growth but very rapid growth at the top continually separates the extremely wealthy, not 1%, but 1% of 1%. The extremely wealthy end up holding more and more of the cards in the game, and they end up, particularly with the Supreme Court decisions recently, being able to influence the outcome of elections, as they always have, but even more so.
Yeah.
So I guess what I want to hear from folks out there is, are they aware of this? Do they disagree with it? If they're aware of it and they agree with it, what do they believe should be done? And I think it's an important conversation. I think it's very fundamental, and we can talk more about Piketty's work, but I think more important perhaps is to hear from folks out there and their reaction to this.
Let's do that.
Okay, and remember, you've got a 3-minute limit, folks, so organize your thoughts.
503-231-8187 is the number to call. Let's begin with George.
Hi, George.
Hey, good morning, guys. It's hard to add much to what you've said. I thought I'd just mention a few authors, including
sure.
especially Karl Marx, but also John...
Karl Marx! Oh, he's a communist! Ah! Go
right,
ahead.
And a guy who got so much right, and although there were some small errors in prediction, there were certainly some terrific insights into the destructive tendencies that would not go away, in fact, would get worse. And I'll mention John Bellamy Foster of Monthly Review Press, and the sociologist Durber, Charles Durber, who wrote a great book, Marx's Ghost, about what do we do in this multiply complex mess that capitalism has led us into. And all the issues include, among others, the crisis of the system of capital's control over society, which is wrecking the biosphere and destroying what we thought was anything like democracy and social justice, causing massive extinctions. So that covers some of the things, and I think you guys are already on the track of so much of it, so I'll get out of the way here and just be interested in following this discussion on the air.
Well, thank you very much. You know, I agree with your points. It's really important to understand that the greater crisis possibly is not a crisis in which the working class rises up as a proletariat and gains control of the economy and of the nation state. Probably the greater crisis is that because of the lack of real insight on the part of so many of these wealthy people, they're really insulated from reality. We may end up finding ourselves in a huge crisis beyond the human, a crisis of the environment, which will, and I think this is very likely, which will engulf us all. And
I think you're right.
You know,
I think the system, István Mészáros, a well-known Marxist philosopher of our time, has pointed out that the controlling power of capital increases the destructiveness of the system, and has now reached the point where there is a gigantic global crisis of the system itself, calling into question the tyranny of the rule of investment for profit, and the results are more and more plain. And so it calls into question, isn't it about time that we see that it is really the system, and that we need an alternative system which puts the biosphere and social justice well before anything like profit. So I'll get off.
Yeah, no, I appreciate it, and thank you very much for the call.
Thank you so much.
You know, I'm using Paul Krugman's piece. By the way, if you're interested, a publication that I read a great deal is the New York Review of Books, and there's an article by Paul Krugman, who also has a column twice a week in the New York Times, in which he talks about this whole issue.
Thank you so much. I'm going to get that article. This sounds like something that Krugman he's gone a little bit beyond where he did before.
I think so. Anyway, I'm going to...
Thanks for the call.
Thank you so much for the call.
There is a redistribution in favor of capital underway. Notably, corporate profits have soared since the financial crisis began, while wages, including the wages of the highly educated, have stagnated. And we saw the labor struggle at Portland State University is a great example of that. In fact, we're going to see that all over the country. We saw how the state of Tennessee manipulated an election to keep the United Auto Workers out of Volkswagen, even though Volkswagen's management wanted to create a cooperative relationship between labor and itself with the UAW. So we're seeing a pattern. We're seeing a pattern that's both ideological and at the same time economic, which is creating for all of us greater poverty, greater stress, greater distress in the face of an onrushing environmental catastrophe.
Yes. And there also exists, and we cannot ignore this, there also exists a media establishment that has been dedicated for several decades now to repeating ad nauseum and reinforcing the notion that it is somehow un-American and unproductive to impose an undue tax burden on the wealthy because they create jobs, for example, because they, the beneficent ones, are the means by which the rest of us can be elevated. This flies in the face of living memory and of all economic evidence to the contrary.
Yeah, it really does. And I if there are people out there, and I'm sure there must be several, that really disagree with us, we would also like to hear from you. So remind yourself that you should use 3 minutes to make your argument, because longer than that, everybody goes crazy. Not any insult to you, but, you know, it's just the reality of radio. So we'd like to hear from you, 231-8187.
Joe, good morning.
Good morning. I would like to comment on the notion of inequality coming to dominate our conversation about what capitalism is and what's wrong with it, mm-hmm. and what the solutions or improvements to it might look like. You know, we're coming up on International Workers' Day, May 1st, and, you know, traditionally the fight against capitalism wasn't about fighting inequality as like some singular problem, but, you know, exploitation and alienation, and we talk about creating jobs, but, you know, the imposition of the wage system itself creates so much drudgery and suffering and takes up our lives from things that we might be better suited to do, that it seems a bit incomplete, and not just in a we're getting their way to focus on inequality without talking about exploitation and alienation. So if you guys could just maybe address where that comes into the 21st century critique and transformation of capitalism, that would be of interest to me.
Okay, well, thank you very much for the call.
Excellent question.
I really appreciate it. One of the points that needs to be understood is that direct increases in inequality occur because ownership of capital is always much more unequally distributed than labor income. The effects don't stop there. And now I'm quoting Krugman. The effects don't stop there because when the rate of return on capital greatly exceeds the rate of economic growth, the past tends to devour the future. Societies inexorably tend toward dominance by inherited wealth.
So what does that mean? That means when conditions exist such that you make more money investing than working, then the rich get richer and the poor get poorer.
Right.
And we've had those sorts of conditions now for the better part of a decade.
Right. And we have also at the same time, parallel to this, an ideology on the right, encouraged by, for example, Fox News, that suggests that the government, the whole United States government, is invalid in any effort it makes to be a fair and just government. The most recent case that immediately comes to my mind is the kerfuffle around cattle grazing on public lands.
Yeah.
In the state of Nevada, all the crazy right-wingers, encouraged by Fox News, showed up with their guns, ready to shoot, apparently, federal officers who were gathering the cattle of a guy who for years and years and years has refused to pay his rents on Bureau of Land Management land.
So he's been stealing.
Yeah, stealing from all of us. And now suddenly you have all these people saying, hey, the government. Well, when you have enormous propaganda put forward by probably what is the most popular sort of news cable channel of all, and when people really fall into the belief in that, and the Rush Limbaughs and so on echo all of that, you create a false consciousness in which people become alienated and angry at the government, not alienated and angry at certain activities that are done by the very wealthy.
Indeed. And there, at the same time, exists an absence of rational voices pushing back on this.
Exactly.
Consider the last presidential campaign, when the topic of, yet again, removing the Bush tax cuts, raising the taxes on the very wealthy came up. And Mitt Romney was able to say with a straight face and largely unopposed that it was a bad, bad idea to raise taxes on the job creators in a bad economy. When, in fact, all economic theory tells us it's a very good idea to raise taxes on the very wealthy in a bad economy.
Well, and in fact, the period of time, these 30 great years post-war, there are a variety of causes. But one of the most significant things about that era is to understand that wealth was heavily taxed.
Yes.
And yet the wealthy became wealthier.
Yes. Here's the deal. This is the straight truth, listeners. Capitalism works best when it is muzzled. It works best when the wealthiest are taxed at a robust rate and that revenue invested in infrastructure and in social stability. That's when capitalism works the best.
Because demand can then accelerate.
Yes.
And people will buy stuff.
Yes. Which means that most people are going to have a job that pays a decent wage. And most people are going to have access to things like healthcare and affordable housing and decent education and good transportation infrastructure and on and on and on and on. And all of those things suffer when wealth is concentrated in the hands of the very few. This is not rocket science. We have examples of this in living memory. Ask your elders who lived through the Great Depression, through the FDR era, and through the post-war decades.
And what essentially has been done, what really is important about Piketty's work, is he's been able to gather data going, in case of France, all the way back to the beginning of the French Revolution. And in the case of our country and others, beginning around the beginning of the 20th century, and look at that data and gather information about the enormous accrual of wealth. And again, when wealth is stored, I mean, that's probably the best word for it, and handed down, family to family, people marrying each other within this wealth structure, when that happens and when there is no, in fact, real increase in real wages and other benefits to workers, you end up with a society in which there is not only two classes, but you have a very hard situation for most people, while the wealthy get wealthier and wealthier, obscenely wealthy, in fact.
Yep.
And that's what we're seeing.
I want to quote Krugman again here from the New York Review of Books. Before World War I, the 1% received around a fifth of total income in both Britain and the United States. By 1950, that share had been cut by more than half.
Right.
This doesn't mean, however, that rich people suddenly dried up and blew away, or that, in fact, wealthy people weren't able to get wealthier. They were. We still had a group of people who did very, very well during that period. The difference is that the broad masses of people did very, very well also. Now, I'm not looking back to the 1950s as some sort of idyllic period, because let's not forget, black folks and white folks had to use different drinking fountains and restrooms and all sorts of things. But what does a broadening of equality mean for those types of situations? Well, it means when there are good jobs and good wages out there, it gives people the breathing room in their lives to push back against other sort of social inequalities. It creates the conditions, for example, in which things like the civil rights movement can flourish, or the anti-war and countercultural movements can flourish. That's what it means to have a robust and growing middle class. It's not strictly about the economics, but the economics provide the seeds for all these other sorts of change.
And there's another ideological language game that's being played today. We talk about the middle class as though it were all of the people who are not rich. In fact, there is a working class, and there is a class within and or under that working class which is quite impoverished, and we just simply ignore it. We simply we use policing to enforce our laws on it. We use a school system that teaches that inequality is legitimate and justified. We use all kinds of ideological as well as physical restraints against the rise of the interest of the worker.
Yeah.
And it's just become normative, and nobody even thinks about it anymore. The big kind of legitimization of that, I guess, would be the failure of the Soviet Union and the failure of that form of socialism.
Yeah, but that really wasn't socialism as most people think of it.
Well, it wasn't. What it was a dictatorship, not of the proletariat, but a dictatorship. Let's hear from people. 231-8187.
Quickly before we do.
Yeah, go ahead.
Speaking of socialism, the countries that a lot of people in this country deride as socialists, I'm talking mostly about the Scandinavian countries, aren't really socialist countries either. They're capitalist countries, but they practice a very muzzled, very highly regulated form of capitalism that benefits the vast majority of their people more than ours does.
Yeah, in fact, in Sweden, that is changing and causing hardship. But the main thing to understand is that social democracy is a system which accommodates capital, which accommodates wealth, even disproportionate wealth, at the same time as making sure that taxation provides the necessary services, the housing, the education, the health care, and so on, that people, ordinary people, hardworking people like you and I, need.
Yeah. And let's think for a minute about what we might do all of a sudden if we were to adopt a model similar to this one, or a set of conditions similar to those that prevailed after the Second World War. If we were to suddenly raise taxes on the very rich and the government all of a sudden had a bunch more money to spend without going into debt, what might we do with that? Well, I imagine somebody who's been out of work for a while might jump at the chance to take a one-year course at a community college to become a fiber optic technician, for example, and then go to work installing fiber optic internet networks all over the country that the government is promoting as a work program.
Electric railroads.
Or we could repair all the crumbling roads and bridges that exist all around the country. Or we could invest heavily in schools and update and modernize science labs in classrooms around the country and employing all kinds of Americans as we did so. This is what you can do when you muzzle capitalism, when you tax the wealthiest at a robust rate. This is what you can do.
And remember, we're not talking about confiscatory processes. We're talking about fairness. We want to hear from you. 231-8187. Remember the three-minute rule. Sean, you're on the air.
Good morning. I think I've got my thoughts relatively well organized.
Yay!
By the way, I recognize your last caller's voice from the Old Mole Variety Hour. I think it's a crime if he doesn't get like 2 hours every day in public affairs on KBOO. I just think he's a brilliant guy.
He is a brilliant guy.
I guess the reason I called, though, is Joe, when my 3 minutes are up, it'd be a shame to miss the chance to hear you riff a little bit on the Ludlow Massacre, the anniversary of which was the 20th last Sunday.
Yeah, I can talk about that, but I'm not sure everybody wants to hear such grim news.
Okay. I guess the point of my call is that, I'm really looking forward to purchasing the new book on Capital, and I've been buying copies of Imagine Living in a Socialist USA, and I read them and I share them with friends, and they're great books and everything. But I was going to college back in the early 90s, and back then I was reading things like I think Barbara Ehrenreich's book Fear of Falling was mm-hmm. out, and Kevin Phillips' book The Politics of Rich and Poor yes. was out. And it's like this cottage industry has kind of sprouted up, and I catch myself like rewatching my documentary of the Weather Underground over and over again, or like there's this German film called The Baader-Meinhof Complex, and I like watch that over and over again, and the rational side of me says like, okay, that's like juvenile, violent, counterproductive, blah blah blah. But then on the other hand, the modern left just seems so incompetent that it's so frustrating. I've tried to be a part of it, and it just seems like we're so ineffectual. And I have to bring up the subject of identity politics. It seems like class, capitalism and imperialism and environment take a back seat to race, gender, and sexual orientation. And it's so frustrating because those capitalism, imperialism, and environment are universal themes, whereas you mm-hmm. turn people off in droves when you obsess over race, gender, and sexual orientation. So that's the point of my call.
Thank okay, you. Well, thank you very much. Gosh, you know, he just opened up a lot of
he
material.
Sure did.
And I don't think we have time in our very limited presentation to really deal with it. Just briefly, he asked about Ludlow Massacre.
Yeah.
Let's be clear about this. The Rockefellers, John D. in particular, owned the mines in Ludlow, Colorado. There was a strike. The strikers created a tent city, and their resistance was effective. The mines were not open. And as a response to that, the Rockefeller interests pressed the governor of the state to use militias, National Guard troops, to attack the Ludlow campers in their
wow.
tents. And murdered, I can't remember the number, 13 people, something like that, were just killed outright. Suffered enormously. It was a kind of publicity disaster for John D. Rockefeller. So he then hired one of the first PR agents in the country, and his people had him giving out dimes to poor kids in his little top hat and whatnot. And it was just the beginning of an effort to rebuild and recreate a notion of the goodness and the rightness and the righteousness of wealth in the United States. So it was a pattern both of the slaughtering of workers and the destruction of labor, and then on top of that, a creation of a notion set, which Romney typified.
Yeah,
he did. The good wealth.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah, Romney was the guy on the Monopoly box.
Really,
much.
I mean, you know, and going with the Supreme Court, corporations are people too.
Yeah, the caller also mentioned that the modern left is incompetent. I would say the modern left is disenfranchised.
Yeah, I don't think it's fair.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, the modern left is not represented in Congress in any significant way. Nobody who can call themselves a leftist is in any position to wield influence on anything, really. Not at the national level.
Well, in fact, we've been very, very, very successful. Our ruling class has essentially destroyed the left wing of the Democratic Party. If you look at what happened way back in 1944, when Henry Wallace was removed from the vice presidency and Harry Truman was installed, while the sick, very sick President Roosevelt could do nothing about that. And as a result, we got in with the death of Roosevelt in 45. Actually, this month, April 12th, we suddenly see the rise of an ignorant, reactionary, Midwestern, petty politician from a machine political operation in Kansas City, who then naively and evilly goes ahead and creates the Cold War. leads the Cold War.
Yeah, he dropped two bombs.
Yeah, and dropped two, and opened up the atomic war age, which we're still in the shadow of, very much so.
If you want to contest my claim that the modern left is not represented at the national level, I'm talking about Congress in particular, there exists a Tea Party caucus in Congress, and there exists a vocal part of the right-wing base to which the Republican Party must kowtow if it wants to succeed at all. There is no analog on the left. Democrats are not required to kiss the ring of the Occupy movement before they can hope to have the endorsement of voters.
The image of kissing the ring of the Occupy movement is pretty funny.
I know, it's ludicrous.
Would that be like a cigar ban?
Right.
You know?
Because it doesn't exist. It doesn't exist. The far right holds sway over the Republicans to an enormous degree, and they're simply not an analog on the left. I wish that it were so. I wish that there was a powerful leftist coalition that Democrats had to listen to in order to succeed.
Well, but
that would be a good thing.
This is no accident. The entire media establishment, by the way, notable exceptions are in cable and satellite broadcast because they open up new channels that are possible for people to watch or listen to, as it were. And the fact of the matter is that that may change the game, but not very likely.
No.
The way in which our system is organized is for us to accept an enormous degree of pushing a product, most of it toxic, to all of us in lieu of real analysis of, for example, environmental issues. And even when those issues are covered by the mainstream media, it's covered in such a manner that there's no real analysis of exactly who holds power and what is to be done.
No. And electoral politics have become a function of spending money.
Well,
and
basically,
now that the limits have been completely removed on that front, the people who have all the money now get to decide every election.
Yes. Well, that's absolutely going to be true. And it even though it's a democratic process, or more or less one, the decision in 2000 in Florida puts question to that.
Yeah.
But even though that's the case, we have a structure, a system that basically disenfranchises huge numbers of people and basically makes electoral politics a game that most people don't want to play with.
Yeah, our process is democratic in name only.
So let's hear from some more folks. 231-8187. Remember the 3-minute limit. Organize your thoughts and give us your best.
James, welcome. Clock's ticking.
Good morning, gentlemen. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have my thoughts written down, so it'll be 30 seconds.
Cool. All right.
Go for it.
The rise of the 1% is due to adopting economic nationalism. Economic nationalism is an economic system that came into being in America because we expanded the role of the central government beyond its constitutional limitation, which makes economic nationalism / capitalism progressive left policy. The Republican Party was a progressive left party before the Democratic Party became a progressive left party. Woodrow Wilson aligned the Democratic Party with the Republican Party with the Federal Reserve Act, the 16th and 17th Amendment to the Constitution. FDR moved the Democratic Party to the left of the Republican Party with his New Deal. Today we are debating left-wing tyranny versus left-wing tyranny.
Okay.
Okay, thanks for the call.
Thanks a lot, James.
Well, in short, I'd have to say, well, no. But go ahead.
But no, I think he touches upon something that is real, however, and is vital, which is, and something we said a little earlier, that both of the major political parties, and really in this country there are these two parties, which are simply access to power issue based parties, and the fact is that they are, whatever James's theoretical model may be, they are in fact both servants of a ruling class.
Agreed. And he described a system of economic nationalism, and I have to agree with him there. Nationalism has been used to advance the economic interests of the ruling class time and time again. But he says that's because that happened because the federal government expanded beyond its constitutional mandate. I'd say that's putting the cart before the horse.
Well, let's let other callers talk to us.
So.
If you're just tuning in, we really are talking about a recent book that knocked both of us out, Capital in the 21st Century by Thomas Piketty. And this book has turned into a surprise bestseller.
It has, yeah.
And it is very, very important. I also want to mention the fact I think that Barbara Ehrenreich is going to be in town this weekend. You might want to catch her at.
Sure. Yeah, and if you want to take an economic treatise with you to the beach this summer, this is the one.
Yeah, and it, you know, it's back ordered at the bookstores right now.
Yeah.
So it's a surprise that it's a big success.
Who's next, Steve? Michael, good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Okay. Very quickly, what the current problem is that the voters are faced with a choice between the tyranny of wealth and the tyranny of the bureaucracy, and they don't like either one.
I don't see that. I think that's not the choice we're faced with.
You guys are the advocates of, look at the tyranny of the wealthy, how terrible that is. But there's also the tyranny of the bureaucracy, which imposes irrational, horrible rules on the people, and the people don't like it, and that's why they're not necessarily willing to give the government more power. Let me give you an example from my own life. I work for a relatively smaller bureaucracy than the federal government. I work for a community college, and the community college decided it needed to have goals. And so they decided one of their goals was going to be teach our students about cultural diversity. So far, so good. I mean, you know, you can't argue with that. That's a nice thing to learn about. And then they mandate that every single class in the college has to evaluate how well it's doing at teaching its students about cultural diversity. So I teach computer science. I teach people how to write code. The true answer for me would be, I don't do that. It's orthogonal to what I do. I have nothing to do with cultural diversity when I teach people how data is stored inside the memory of a computer. And that's not acceptable. I have to come up with a way of evaluating how I teach my students about cultural diversity, even though I don't do it. So there are just tens of thousands of examples of this. If you put, there are just tens of thousands of examples of this. And
yeah, but the voters are not confronted by your community college bureaucracy at the polls.
What, say again?
The voters are not confronted by your community college's goals when they go to the polls.
No, they're confronted by the federal government's goals, which are just as irrational in many respects as the community college's bureaucracy.
Okay, well, listen, I think your point is interesting. There's a whole bunch of reasons why we can respond to that. We are under the gun to try to get as many callers in as possible.
Okay.
And I want to thank you.
One last very quick comment.
Okay.
All right.
You guys should also respect the three-minute rule. You go on for a lot more than 3 minutes between calls.
Oh,
yeah,
well.
See, but there's a power imbalance there. Inequality at play.
Yes. Anyway, thanks very much for the call. Well, he's got a point, but I don't care.
Yes. We are the 1% of this radio program, Joe and myself.
Yeah.
Deal with it.
But what we're trying to do, let's be clear, is to get as many callers in as possible. That's why the three-minute rule. So let's go to our next caller.
We are the call creators.
Oh, wait, you have to do some business.
Yes,
speaking of which.
Coming up this morning on KVOO, at 9, journalists Robert McChesney and John Nichols speak about their book, Dollarocracy, and about money and politics.
Woo!
At 10, Chris Hondre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, Flashpoints presents a recent speech by theoretical physicist and Pacifica radio host Dr. Michio Kaku, entitled The Future of the Mind. He is so cool.
He is cool.
There's sort of an astrophysicist chic going on right now. I really am enjoying it.
Well, yeah.
Yeah. At 11 on stage and studio, host Dime Roberts talks on location with actress and director Olga Sanchez, artistic director of Milagro Theater. They cover everything from her featured role in Learn to Be Latina and Milagro's upcoming season. Yes?
I just want to say Milagro Theater is wonderful.
They are wonderful.
That's all.
And at 11:30 on Art Focus, host Ava Lake speaks with Vanessa Rennick, founder and janitor of the Oregon Department of Kick-Ass, about her show at the Art Gym.
And she's wonderful, too. I want to praise those people.
And let's hear it for the Department of Kick-Ass.
Yeah!
All this and more coming up today on KBOO.
Yeah.
I'm Abe, that's Joe. This is The Abe and Joe Show.
And we're talking about capital in the 21st century, both the book and the idea. And we're talking about how evidence, real good, hardcore evidence, shows the accruing of wealth at the top and the consequences thereof.
That's right.
And it's real.
Yep.
But we do want to hear from you, 231-8187.
Yeah. And in this context, it's important to note that you and I all are the call creators. So it would be a bad idea to impose any limits on our the time
right,
we speak.
Right, we're the call creators.
So we can speak as long as we want.
Oh, absolutely.
The rest of you, though, have to abide by the rules.
Okay.
All right, BJ, good morning.
Hi, where is Imago Theater?
Imago Theater is on Southeast 8th Avenue, right across the street from KBOO.
Oh, really?
Is it?
Mm-hmm. Okay, oh, cool. I want to say
that's Imago Theater, not Milagro Theater. That's somewhere else.
Oh, what'd you say again?
Imago Theater is right across the street from KBOO. The Milagro Theater is somewhere else.
Is that the one you're talking about?
The one I read in the promos is Milagro Theater. Yes.
That means miracle, miracle theater.
The miracle theater, just like the church down the road there.
Yeah, indeed, yes.
God's miracle, Christ or something.
Something.
Okay.
Something.
Thank you for being there and giving us your time of 1 hour. And I intend to sell my other 2 minutes because I'm going to limit mine to 1 minute. Here we go.
All right.
Finish it off in 20 seconds. How do we rearrange, or what is it possible to have, I don't know if it is, but I mean, maybe we need thinking about the Supreme Court. How is a Supreme Court, 12 people just allowed to push it around, you know, like they do, making a huge rich class.
Well, you're raising an interesting question. I'm going to let you go, and I'm going to answer you a little bit. I'm just going to say that when an attempt was made to limit the power of the court by increasing its membership for those under the age of 70, under Roosevelt, the Congress and a lot of Americans simply balked. 12 men or women on the Supreme Court is not constitutionally described. The number is not fixed by anything but tradition.
Yeah, but there's nine. There's nine.
Did I say nine?
You said 12.
I said 12?
Yeah.
I prefer 12.
Well, so shall it be.
All right. Never mind. All right. Good old craziness. 231-8187.
Hey, thanks for the call, man.
Thanks
get
for the
call.
Get
you guys on it and change it.
Maybe it should be 12. Yeah. Okay.
Let's
or 13.
Have the disciples there.
Hey, thanks for the call. 503-231-8187. You and I on the Supreme Court, that'd be pretty fun, man.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, what would be the likelihood of that?
It's pretty close to zero.
I don't think anyone... Never mind. Okay.
John, you're next.
Well, we've crossed that line, which you were talking about. Last week, I was hearing, I forgot where it was, people from, you know, big thinkers, economics, political science.
Mm-hmm.
We are now an oligarchy.
Yeah, we are.
We have been classified that in the academic terms.
Yeah, and with lots of evidence.
Yeah, well, that's what part of the evidence is. And it's actually 0.1% that control everything. I heard that if you made over $600,000 a year, you were considered 1%.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're like Russia. Well, Russia is trying to get away from oligarchy. We're trying to go, we succeeded going into.
Well, I think historically and in many other ways, comparing us with Russia is a little bit pointless.
Well, yeah, but I mean, that's two different cultures. But one of the things I think is pushing all this wealth is the military-industrial complex.
Oh, of course. I would call it the military.
I mean, why do you want to spend $50 billion on an aircraft carrier?
I would call it the military-industrial congressional complex.
And, and the way in which it war, you're going down.
Well, the way in which it works is that the military procurers have established corporate interests in almost every state, including Oregon, where companies like Boeing and so on that make military goods are the job providers. And the consequence is that no congressional person wants to speak out
against
the jobs.
Yeah, it's interesting. A Republican president is the one who warned everybody.
Yeah, Eisenhower.
Eisenhower. And a military man to boot. Anyway, thanks a lot for the call.
Yeah, I encourage everybody to watch that Eisenhower speech. You can Google it, Eisenhower Farewell Address.
Yeah.
He warns us about the military-industrial complex.
Yeah. Well, you know.
Yeah. And he asked, why do you spend $50 billion on an aircraft carrier? And the answer, I think, is, well, I mean, you want the one with the seat warmers and the power windows, right?
Oh, and the killer missiles.
Yeah, and the nice stereo.
And the atomic weapons.
Yeah.
Don't forget the atomic weapons.
Who's next? BT, good morning.
Yes, good morning. You know, I wanted to talk about something that's just repeated ad nauseum for decades now, and that's this myth that in the 40s, 50s, or whatever, into the early 60s, that there was this 91% tax rate, that all these top 10% or whatever were just getting 90% of their income taken, and that was being spread around.
That's
he's
not
agreeing
how
with you. He's saying it's a myth.
Yeah.
Oh, you're saying that it's a fact.
No, I'm not. I'm agreeing with you.
Okay, because that was just a rate on paper. They were paying probably the same amount that they've been paying for, you know, maybe 80 years, because the whole idea was if you buy bonds or, you know, invest in this, you know, there's just a certain report, not reported, but the adjusted income was always low. So they were probably paying, you know, 30 or something equivalent to what they're paying now. And so that means that the government wasn't getting that money. So you can't really say that, oh, the 50s were great because we were sucking up 90% of the wealthy people's money and doling it out.
Well, we have a graduated tax system in this country. That means everybody pays the same. I'm just picking these numbers out of the air here. Everybody pays the same rate up to 50,000.
Uh-huh.
Everybody pays the same rate from 50,000 to 100,000.
Yeah, yeah.
Everybody pay and on, up and up and up. And the higher you go, the higher that marginal rate gets. So when you talk about that 91% figure, a rich person was not forking over 90% of his or her income. The very highest end of their income was taxed at that rate.
Oh, I don't think that they were actually paying that much of above a certain amount. But people still think that 90% of their money was taken. But real
right.
quickly, in my last 60 seconds here, something that really irks me is that, you know, you have these people like the Kennedys, you know, they've had a reputation to go out there and say, oh, we need to raise taxes on the wealthy, blah, 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 yet they're getting this huge allowance because of granddaddy's trust fund. Like, even Carolyn Kennedy, it came out when she was appointed ambassador to Japan by Obama last year, even though she's, you know, has no experience in that, they had to do a little digging into her income and everything. It turned out that last year or the year before that, she made $17 million, and it's virtually tax-free. That's the thing. This money is virtually tax-free. They go around always talking about, oh, this accumulation of wealth and blah, blah, blah. I just wish everybody had a trust fund then in that case.
Well,
doesn't it bother you that someone like Carolyn Kennedy can go around saying, oh, we got to raise taxes on the wealthy in the meantime? You say, oh, here's your $17 million for last
year.
Well,
it doesn't bother me because I have $120 million in income
figures.
Every year. Yeah, sure. Okay, listen, thanks a lot, man.
Okay, Joe and Abe.
And I think you're making an important point, though we might disagree about the number game here.
Well, I think we need to talk about what he brought up.
Yeah.
Is it morally objectionable for somebody to take in, and I don't know if that figure was accurate or not, $17 million, for doing essentially nothing? Is that morally acceptable? I don't think it is.
Well, moral don't play in economics.
Well, clearly.
I mean, obviously, right.
Right.
So the answer is probably not morally acceptable, but we have already perverted any notion of sharing wealth. And we are really not ready to discuss what a legitimate income is. Not just we here at the station, but we as
right.
a nation.
And right now, we are not allowed to entertain a discussion in this country about how much is enough. That is antithetical. We don't talk about that.
Well, I know I don't have enough.
Just a little bit more.
Yeah, just a little bit more.
They asked Rockefeller, old man Rockefeller on his deathbed,
yeah.
how much is enough? And he said, just a little bit more.
But he died.
Right, he did.
All right,
who's next? Karen.
I'm Karen.
Hi, you're on
Go
the
ahead.
Air.
Okay. Well, what has happened, there's been a long-term assault on workers, and we were really quite naive from Alex starting up in 1983 mm-hmm. to the rise of the staffing services, which really destabilized the workforce, and it's about profit. During the last robber baron era, working through a third party was the way you got to work. So it is very much a repeat performance, and it's been very deliberate. And the other thing I would just like to get out there, if people haven't seen Inequality for All, there is a showing this coming Saturday night at the West Hills Unitarian Church on Olson Road, and it's at 7 o'clock, and it's a very informative documentary, and it really, if you don't understand, that will help you. And certainly I would recommend people get active. It's your life.
Well, I want to thank you very much. Do you know the name of the documentary?
It's Inequality for All, Robert Reich documentary.
Right. Oh, right. Yeah, it is good.
He's been doing some really good work on this topic.
And I think it's great that you remind us of the availability of information. Listen, information is out there. The job of all of us is to find it, to work with it, and to make demands that are effective. This really is something that can be turned around, but only if people become very well educated, very aware, and very determined.
Indeed. We had a lot of good calls today.
I think so.
Yeah.
Yeah, we run out of time, and we'll do this topic again. And very soon we'll do another opportunity for women only, because on account of how women are less represented on talk radio.
It's true. Hey, neither of us is a woman.
I've noticed that.
Yeah, I have to.
Okay.
All right, well, thanks, everyone.
You all stay tuned. Remember, the book is Capital in the 21st Century by Piketty. All right.
Bye. Tiananmen Square. It's coming from the field that this ain't exactly real, or it's real, but it ain't exactly there. From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay, democracy is coming.
Tune in Tuesday night at 6 p.m. to Out Loud, KBOO's queer culture radio show.
Out Loud celebrates and serves the lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, queer, questioning, and allied communities.
Out Loud features interviews with local and national community groups, authors, musical talent, and anyone from the queer community.
Connect with us online at kboo.fm/outloud. Tune in Tuesday at 6 p.m. on KBOO Portland.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Redirect Guide, committed to promoting progressive regional businesses based upon the values of sustainability, localism, and social justice. Complete business directory at resourceguide@redirect.com. Good morning. You're listening to KBOO Portland. It's 9 o'clock. Here's what's coming up this morning on KBOO. First on alternative radio, journalists Robert McChesney and John Nichols speak about their book, Dollocracy, about money in politics. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, Flashpoints presents a recent speech by theoretical physicist and Pacifica radio host Dr. Michio Kaku entitled The Future of the Mind. At 11, on stage and studio, host Dime Roberts talks on location with actress and director Olga Sanchez, artistic director of Milagro Theater. They cover everything from her featured role in Learn to Be Latina and Milagro's upcoming season. And at 11:30 on Art Focus, host Ava Lake speaks with Vanessa Rennick, founder and janitor of the Oregon Department of Kick-Ass, about her show at the Art Gym. Thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support to this community radio station. If you are not a member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today. Now let's go